I speak to you in the name of the Spirit who gives life. Amen. The letter arrived in that familiar embossed envelope I used to see so often. Postmarked in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It was covered by the elegant handwriting of my friend Nicholas Denton. That precise italic marking of a precise italic soul. To tell you the truth, although we had exchanged a few notes from time to time, I hadn't seen Nicholas in decades, nor talked to him since we fought over what now seemed like a trivial matter involving aesthetic judgments in music. At the time, it seemed urgent that I convince him of Mozart's surpassing genius. Alas, Nicholas could not hear back past Beethoven. And in the way that young people sometimes let passions cloud their affections, we parted in a mutual huff. If I close my eyes, I can see Nicholas walking resolutely past the huge window of Aristotle's bookshop on Chapel Street in New Haven. Through rain so fine it was like a puff, pulling his raincoat around him, just avoiding the cyclist with the green mohawk hairdo. I should have gone after him, but he had angered me, and the bookshop was more welcoming than his anger. Over the years, I intended to call Nicholas, but life, you know, has a way of turning intentions into regrets, and I never did. On occasion, I would hear about him, read in the alumni magazine about his whereabouts. He would drop me a note announcing the birth of his children, but that was about it. Nicholas rescinded his ambition to be a great choral conductor and studied law. And Nicholas Denton was very good at law. He became an attorney, was admitted to the bar in Connecticut, New York, and Florida, known as Mr. Probate. He passed his years in the relatively elegant salons of the wealthy, helping them leave this life in the hope they had lived good lives. Even now, I'm not sure why I chose to follow Nicholas from afar, why I could not reach out past our silly argument. But when the letter arrived, my hands felt cold, and minutes passed before I could pry it open. "Dear Alan," began the letter, "I don't know why it has taken me so long to write, but now something has compelled me to get in touch with you." I stopped long enough to realize this was not a courtesy note. This was like a written confession. It would take my whole attention. So I folded the letter and replaced it in its elegant envelope and went into the coffee shop to find a corner of solitude and warmth. It's astonishing how comforting a cup of coffee can be, and how it could almost serve as an alchemist of memories. Just sitting by the window of the coffee shop, watching a whole new generation of young people rushing in and out, separated only by glass from the descendant of the cyclist with the green mohawk hairdo, I was decades younger, and the letter lying next to my coffee cup felt like an old friend. A few swallows later, I returned to the letter from Nicholas. "I don't know why I haven't written much or called. It's not that I have forgotten you or the great pleasure we shared when we both thought our lives would unfold in concert halls. I was angry when I left Aristotle's bookshop, and although I thought your stupid lionizing of Mozart was my emotional undoing, I now know that the true fault line of my anger lay much deeper. It was to be found in the crack in my soul." I stopped reading, gazed out the window, losing myself in the fine mist of that unusually warm February evening, not sure what to make of the letter's opening words. "All these years I have hesitated contacting you," continued Nicholas, "because I was certain you would dismiss my anxiety. You had enough to deal with as a priest. You would have thought my worries unworthy of attention. You would have said again, as you often did, 'Nick, you're being too fastidious. So I kept my worries to myself. I've done well, Alan. My three children are now grown. They're so bright and promising. And only you would appreciate this. Last year, my oldest son presented a recital consisting entirely of Mozart sonatas. There was something in the letter from Nicholas that was both fastidious and alarming. Just receiving the letter had unnerved me a little after so many years, but I continued reading. Alan, 3 months ago, my wife died after a brief battle with ovarian cancer. I have lost without her. Through these past decades, she not only loved me more than I deserved, but she let me believe that my life was worth something, that I wasn't wasting it, writing wills and pacifying wealthy clients. She would never hear my occasional longings to have lived a better life. "You've done so well, sweetheart," was her stock and effective response to my periodic episodes. For decades, Maria and my children protected me from paying attention to that crack in my soul. My coffee was cold, so I wandered into the front room of the coffee shop and got a refill. Even that short walk awakened my recollection of all those long past conversations with my friend Nicholas, deep into the night conversations about God and grace and what are we here for, and our mutual anxiety that when we came to the end of our lives, would we have lived well? I was beginning to feel sorry for Nicholas. His letter was clearly a report to his old friend at a moment when he was suspended between pride and hope he felt for his children and his unsurpassable grief. So I picked up the letter once more. "Alan, there have been times and days and moments when none of my success has comforted me or given me any hope. The truth is, and I wouldn't dare even whisper this at the firm, that sometimes I feel nearly dead myself. Not physically, but just in my soul. To everyone else, I must have appeared a success. I even convinced myself that I was a distinguished leader in our profession. I acted the part, of course. How could I not? But at night, this was true even before Maria's illness, when she and I would talk quietly in bed to wind down the day, I felt like a fraud. I still had half a letter to read, and I was already felt both sorrow, surprise, and alarm. From a distance, Nicholas had always seemed so secure. It was hard to listen to this seepage from his soul cracks, but I determined to finish. "What I am about to tell you still puzzles me," wrote Nicholas. "I'm not sure how I came to be sitting along the ocean last week. I had tried to arouse myself by treating myself to fresh grouper. If you ever get to Fort Lauderdale, I will take you to this place, a small plain cafe with outrageously good food. Anyway, I went there to be alone and let the breeze lift my spirits. I hadn't been out really since Maria's funeral, and I suppose it did in a quiet sort of way. As it got towards 10 o'clock, the evening began to wrap its mercy around me. That's the only way I could put it. And finally, I asked the waiter to bring my mango sorbet and coffee. Just as dessert arrived, I heard a voice from behind me. 'Nicholas, is that you?' It was Jesse Kreutzer, another former aspiring musician who discovered that being a rabbi was the only thing that would make him happy in life. I met Jesse a few years ago when we both were involved on the symphony board, but I had not seen him recently. Suddenly, I found myself wishing the coffee shop would add mango sorbet to its menu. But the best I could do was buy another coffee refill. I had more letter to read. A rabbi, how odd, I thought, remembering Nicholas' barely hidden disdain for Jews when we were younger. But this was his story and not mine. Alan Jesse had heard of my wife's illness and death and wanted to express his sympathy. He confessed he had wanted to speak to me earlier, but my firm was involved on the wrong side, wrong to him, of a large estate, and it would have looked bad, he felt, to be seen with me. How ironic that he also had come to the cafe that night, his wife was away, and run into me. I guess I had nowhere to run off to, and he seemed willing to sit and talk, so we did, until just after midnight, they chased us away. As unlikely as it sounds, Alan, Jesse listened to my worries. He had known his own sorrows, his own dark fears, even wondering on occasion whether a rabbi's life would count for anything in the end. Every so often, the breeze from the ocean would gust past us, and we'd stop talking. Sitting on the deck, not far from the edge of the beach, we could even feel a mist of salt water bathing our faces. It was warm and startling all at once, and the breeze and the mist made me feel alive. That's it, Alan. I'm sorry to have written such a long letter. Since that night I met Jesse at the cafe, my life looks and feels a little different. I can't explain it. Maybe I just needed somebody to listen to me. I'm not sure what comes next, but there's a little edge of hope. It's as if I've been blind for a long time, and only now starting to see many things. By the way, if you can resist puffing yourself up, you were right all along. On the drive home from that cafe the other night, the Mozart Clarinet Quintet was playing on the radio. It is radiance beyond compare. Well, I must close this long letter, much too long in coming your way. Tomorrow I have to meet with a client who wishes to make a new will. His grandson eloped with a girl from Pakistan, and my client cannot live with that. Wish me well. It's been such a long time since we last were together. If I could erase my painful exit from Aristotle's bookshop, I would. But if you could find an excuse to visit Fort Lauderdale, I promise you an evening of fresh grouper and mango sorbet you'll never forget. Stay well, my friend. Never give up. Never think you're too old to feel new life wash over you. Oh, one more thing. When you come to Fort Lauderdale, I will move sandcastles and condominiums for you to meet my new friend, Jesse. I think you'd like him. Let's not be strangers anymore. Your old and once again friend, Nicholas Denton. Well, it was late when I laid down the letter from Nicholas and my cup was empty. I sat for a long time, leaning against the window, my eyes closed, hearing not the clamor of the coffee shop a late Saturday night, but the excited chatter at Aristotle's in New Haven. I felt sad for having let so many years go by without retrieving our friendship. My joints creaked a little as I got up, for I'm a lot older now than before, and maybe the cracks began not only in my joints, but in my soul. Out into the night I passed, pausing to wrap my scarf and button my coat. I didn't know quite what to do about Nicholas' invitation to visit. But just then the wind gusted down the avenue, and a fine mist caressed my cheeks. Suddenly I had a fierce hunger for fresh grouper and mango sorbet. And I knew that someday I also would sit and talk with the rabbi by the ocean. Amen.